Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, our weekly performing arts radio magazine. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. The month of September is upon us again, and that means the opening presentations from Bay Area arts organizations, the San Francisco Opera last week, the San Francisco Symphony this coming week, and among others, the opening of the San Francisco Playhouse and ACT seasons. At the Playhouse, Dogfight, the musical. We'll hear from one of the leads, Jeffrey Bryan Adams. At ACT, it's Between Riverside and Crazy by Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Stephen Adley Geergis. I'll talk to him by phone later in the hour, and with regular contributor to Open Air Peter Robinson, who just caught that show recently, as well as the eldest boy at the Marin Theater Company. Peter will offer us his reviews. The Intersection for the Arts is celebrating its 50th anniversary. We'll hear about their offerings from their executive director, Randy Rawlinson. Plus, a special thank you gift offering available only during this hour of Open Air, the final day of our fall membership campaign. Stay with us. San Francisco Playhouse opens their 13th season with the San Francisco premiere of the musical Dogfight, directed by Playhouse co-founder and co-artistic director Bill English. It runs through the 7th of November at the Playhouse's gorgeous theater on the second floor of the Kensington Park Hotel on Post Street. Set in San Francisco and Vietnam, Dogfight is a tender and brutal tale based on the 1991 film starring River Phoenix and Lily Taylor. Dogfight the Musical is the winner of the 2011 Richard Rodgers Studio Production Award and made its off-Broadway debut at Second Stage in 2012, garnering Lucille Lortel Awards for Outstanding Musical and Outstanding Choreography by Christopher Gattelli. Jeffrey Bryan Adams, who plays one of the leads here in San Francisco, Eddie Birdlace, joins me in studio to talk about the production. Jeffrey was born and raised in the Bay Area and went to Santa Clara University prior to study at the New School for Drama in New York City. While in New York, he performed in a number of plays on and off Broadway, including a reading with Nathan Lane at the 2013 Angels Ajar benefit. Back in the Bay Area now, he's performed in San Jose Stage Company's Death of a Salesman and the Addams Family musical, and at the Playhouse, San Francisco Playhouse, in Into the Woods. Wonderful job on that. Promises, Promises, also extraordinary. And now the season opener, Dogfight. Jeffrey, welcome to KLW on Open Air.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for your great work in the musicals at the Playhouse already.
Thank you. It's been a blast.
Well, now, we got to talk about the title, Dogfight, and mm-hmm. that initially, for me, evokes air battles along the lines of Snoopy and the Red Baron. Unfortunately, not the case in this title, is it?
Yes, quite the opposite, actually. So,
boys the title, behaving badly, right?
Yes, yes. Dogfight refers to basically what happens is the story follows this group of young Marines. They are stateside one night before they ship off to fight in the Vietnam War, and they follow the long line of tradition that the Marines have passed down, throwing a quote-unquote dogfight, which is basically going out in the city of San Francisco and finding the ugliest girl they can find and putting $50 in a pot, and whoever brings the ugliest girl to a dance that night and wins the competition, they win the pot.
And I guess in 1963, $150 was...
That is pretty solid, yeah.
That's pretty solid coin. Yeah. Now, Ben Brantley headlined his New York Times review in 2012, calling it Cruel, Tuneful Jerk in Love. Mm-hmm. Is that you?
That's me, yeah. Okay. That would be me, yeah. Yeah, very much so. I think my character is great because he sort of gets to show that side of things. He is kind of a jerk at the start, and Over the course of the play, you eventually see a more compassionate side of him, and he's sort of growing up throughout the play. So you get to see both sides for sure.
Mm-hmm. What about your other two that make up your trio of Marines?
Yeah, we call ourselves the three Bs. We have Boland, who's kind of the rough around the edges from the south and big guy. He's probably the most Marine looking of the three of us. And a leader between the two of us as well. And then we have Bernstein, the kind of nerdy archetype who comes in, and he's just really focused on losing his virginity. So priority number one for him.
All right. Yeah. Well, let's hear some music from the original soundtrack. Tell us, set up the song Come to a Party. This is basically the premise of the whole.
Right, yeah. So this first song you're going to hear is my character Eddie Birdlace coming into a diner, and he's sort of fallen upon desperate times finding a girl for the evening, and finds this this young woman who works at the diner, and he is thrown on the charm and really trying to get her to come with him tonight.
And then more with my guest, Jeffrey Brian Adams.
Well, I better shove off soon. Gotta get to a party. Say, maybe you'd like to go with me.
A party? Oh, well, I,
Well, if you don't want to go, just say so.
Well, it's just, I mean, I just met you.
Well, you know my birthday now. Shown you my middle name. See, I'm an open book. Have a look. This ain't no pickup game. I heard your pretty voice. Then we saw eye to eye on all that music stuff, not on fluff. We didn't have to try. Now isn't that rare? That kind of connection. So why not come to a party with me? Why not come to this party? A five-piece band, I'll take your hand, Rose, and twirl you around. Buy you a drink, don't stop to think, say yes. Come to a party with me. Just say yes.
I don't know, Eddie.
My old man's always saying you can't steal second base with your foot on first. Sometimes you gotta gamble, Rose. You can bet on me. Born in Buffalo to humble Christian folks. My old man raised me right, real polite. No telling dirty jokes. A Wally Cleaver type. Ate every Brussels sprout. My mama's pride and joy, golden boy. Your average Eagle Scout. Now look in these eyes. They ain't gonna hurt you. So why not come to a party with me? Come on, it's just a party. A great excuse to cut it loose, Rose, and do what you feel. Hey, just for a night, no holding tight, let...
Eddie Birdlace in the persona of Derek Klena in the original off-Broadway cast recording, and his pickup song, Come to a Party, from Dogfight, currently at the San Francisco Playhouse. My guest, who is playing Eddie Birdlace, Jeffrey Brian Adams in studio. Hey again, Jeffrey.
Hello again.
Well, he's a charmer.
He is.
He's a charmer. And hopefully, you know, there's some redemption at the end, yes?
There is.
Oh, that's good.
Very much so.
So what sort of we heard some of the music there. What do you think of this? Benj Pasek and Justin Paul. Had you heard their music before this?
Not really. This was really the first introduction I had to Pasek and Paul, and they're an incredible writing team together. They make some beautiful music. They also are notable for their Christmas Story musical that they've done. They worked on that as well. But in terms of just storytelling and bringing the movie version to life for the stage, they have done a wonderful job just capturing a lot of the kind of rock ballad, testosterone-driven Marine feel in the beginning, and having that sort of deconstruct throughout the play into some really beautiful, lovely ballads sung by by the women and men alike.
So more like instead of a pit orchestra, and a combo that's accompanying the music.
Yeah, I believe we have a 5 or 6 piece combo, and we had our sing through the other night, and it's going to be great. It's just like a rock band. They're killer. Yeah.
All right. As we continue this conversation, I just want to interrupt for one moment, saying that we are in our fall membership campaign, and the Playhouse has been very generous to offer some vouchers for anything happening in the 2015-16 season. Yours for a gift of $200 if you make that call now, 800-525-9917. We'll give you a pair of vouchers for any performance or production that you'd like in the 2015-16 season of the San Francisco Playhouse. And we're only offering it during this hour, during this part of the membership drive. So 800-525-9917, a $200 gift that gets you two vouchers to the San Francisco Playhouse. Give that some thought.
It's a great deal.
I think so. If I'm there, I'll even buy you a drink at intermission.
There you go.
All right. So the setting, 1963 San Francisco and Vietnam?
Yeah, so it kind of jumps back and forth between 1963 and 1967. So it kind of shows pre and post Vietnam War going off and upon their return as well. The 1963 actually takes place the night before JFK is assassinated, to add a little extra context to the show. So these Marines are going in overseas and fighting for what they think is right and what JFK and everybody has instilled in them, and they come back kind of broken down, and you see that in the 1967 portions.
And how different is this musical from the 1991 film? Did you see the film? Did you?
I did. Yeah, I watched the film. It's subtly different in terms of characters. I think there are like 4 B's instead of 3. They kind of switch it up a bit.
Budgetary reasons.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, but otherwise, I mean, in terms of the story and the overall plot, it's pretty much the same. And the dogfight sequence itself is very, very similar to the musical, but I think the music only helps tell the story deeper, and the choreography we have is going to help that story come across as well.
Very nice. And what's happening for you after this run? This runs through November 7th. You got some other stuff on the books?
I do, yeah. Coming up November 18th, pretty close right after the closing of this show, I'm going to be doing a cabaret night at Feinstein's at the Nico.
Nice.
Then I'm going to be heading down to Foster City for a production of 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. I'll be playing Chip, the Boy Scout. And
well, let's back up a minute to the Feinsteins. What's your repertoire specialty for that?
I'm a big like Sinatra guy. Grew up listening to all that. So I'm going to be singing a lot of classic standards.
And you and me both, baby.
There you go. Hey, right. Old Blue Eyes. Yeah. Yeah, and some holiday music as well, just kind of to ring in the season. And
sweet.
Yeah, yeah, a little home for the holidays.
We'll look forward to that as well.
Yeah.
Well, let's go out with one more tune from Doghouse. We're going to hear Hometown Heroes Ticker Tape Parade. I think that's pretty self-explanatory.
Yes.
Dogfight the Musical is at San Francisco Playhouse through the 7th of November, sfplayhouse.org for more information. And if you'd like vouchers for that very production and you're able to offer a $200 gift to KLW, well, make that call now. 800-525-9917. Jeffrey Brian Adams, thank you so much for your good work at the Playhouse and elsewhere.
Thank you.
We'll have you in again.
Thanks for having me.
More music from Dogfight the Musical.
Schoolboy, awful green, trained, ordained as a mean marine. Now they can't f*** off young buck, cradling an M14. Da 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 da. Teach a gook to hold a gun. Serve your year and then you're done. Homeward bound, the boy gets crowned as Cleveland's new favorite son. At the Hometown Hero Ticker Tape Parade. Candy and lemonade. It's a Hometown Heroes Ticker Tape Parade. Can't get that in the Penny Arcade. Da 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 afternoon.
A band on hand with a marching tune.
Your name is Will. The flint's unveiled.
Your face on a big balloon. Ta-da-da-da.
Watching busty gloves. Paint at strong claws like cats and
fleas. Yeah, let them fight to spend the night.
And stain up that last white sheet. Yeah, at the hometown heroes ticker tape parade. Telling tales of a brave brigade. A hometown heroes ticker tape parade.
It's your time to shine.
Time to get like me and you. We're heroes through and through. Semper Fi, do or die. You're a goddamn hero.
Can't you hear it, boys?
You're a goddamn hero.
Can't you hear it coming, 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 coming?
From the Hometown Heroes Ticker Tape Parade and the musical Dogfight, currently at the San Francisco Playhouse through the 7th of November. Information at sfplayhouse.org. And vouchers for the San Francisco Playhouse generously being offered during this, our fall membership campaign, for a $200 gift to local public radio. We'll give you two vouchers to anything that's happening in the 2015-16 season of the San Francisco Playhouse. Those vouchers are available only by phone, 800-525-9917, if you're able to make a $200 contribution. Later this hour, I'll be talking with Stephen Adley Geergis, who's the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of Between Riverside and Crazy. Peter Robinson will also be in on that conversation, and Peter will have an additional review for some theater happening in Marin. But next, it's Intersection for the Arts, which celebrates five decades of continuous service to Bay Area artists and audiences with The Circle, a series of performing literary and visual arts programs commemorating its extraordinary past and showcasing the next generation of artists who will shape the cultural landscape of tomorrow. Executive Director at Intersection for the Arts, Randy Rollison, joins me in studio now to talk about the programs. Randy has had over 30 years of experience as an artistic director, producer, presenter, and manager of nonprofits, in addition to a longer career as an actor and director. When he was in New York City, he was the co-founder and served as producing artistic director of HOME for Contemporary Theater and Art in Tribeca, as well as under the banner of the New York Shakespeare Festival at the Joseph Papp Theater. He is also a co-founder and co-artistic director of HERE Arts Center in Soho and served as executive artistic director of the Cleveland Public Theater after that. During his career, he has helped over 1,000 new works of theater, dance, opera, and performance art reach the stage, and the list of artists he's collaborated reads like a who's who of the theater world, including Eve Ensler, Christopher Durang, John Leguizamo, Steve Buscemi, Allison Janney, Dylan McDermott, Olympia Dukakis, Tony Kushner, and many others. We only have an hour here for open air, so I got to stop there. With too many awards to mention as well, I will just mention the aforementioned Eve Ensler's The Vagina Monologues, which garnered a 1997 Obie Award and was a Drama Desk nominee. Randy Rollison, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks for having me here.
Of course, 50 years of Intersection. My goodness, how did it all start?
It began in the Tenderloin and the Mission and North Beach, and they were three Protestant ministries who were working to serve what they called disenfranchised youth in those neighborhoods. And they were run by conscientious objectors. So you can get out of the draft in the Vietnam War, which was escalating at that time, and you could do service in the community. So then those three merged through a grant from the Glide Foundation to form the initial Intersection, which was initially an arts and religious program. But after the first couple of years, they just went full-bore arts. So it's got these deep roots in community, and especially with working with youth. Mm-hmm. And all of the art that we've supported over the decades has really been about art and community.
So is there still a church base to it, or at least a church involvement? None at all?
None at all, no. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And let's talk some specifics about some of the programs that are coming up. Ain't Nothing Tender, in collaboration with What Kids Can Do and the Boys and Girls Clubs of San Francisco. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to have this particular piece in the celebrations is that, you know, with our roots in the Tenderloin and with working with youth, we have had a partnership with the Tenderloin Boys and Girls Club. And this show really represents something amazing about what art can do and the stories it can tell and the narratives that it can frame. They gave the teenagers cameras that they go out into their neighborhood. They take the pictures of the things they see. And they are unflinching. You know, but it also, there were younger kids who were given cameras, and they have a totally different take. You know, this is their neighborhood. This is where they play, where they eat, where all their friends are and their families. And so there's a lighter side of it, a more nuanced side that we don't really see all the time. So I really wanted the involvement of that.
And so what happens with that raw footage once it's brought in back to the center?
What they did is they worked with a team to teach the kids how to write, and they had to do reflections on each of the photographs that they took. So at the bottom of each piece, you're able to see what the kid thought when he was taking the picture of the guy with the liquor bottles, or the guy who's hugging his dog and has no place to go. So they really were able to take those, give their own personal reflection in words, and then the combination of those two is really startling when you take a look at it, what they're observing.
Wow. And let's go on with what's happening, also called the Portrait Project, Stepping into the Light.
Yes, Patricia Warren, she's a member of our CORE program, and she's been going into the single-room occupancy hotels for about 7 years around holiday times, and she sets up a formal portrait studio in the lobby and then invites the residents of the hotels to go up, and they go put on their finest, and they come down, and she does a formal portrait for them. And it's incredible because it strips away the background of the Tenderloin, of the lobby of the SRO, and it brings to the forefront these beautiful images of these incredible people who are living their lives there. And it's celebratory, and it's you can feel the hearts of these people in these portraits. And then she gives them to them as a gift.
Now, we talked about this being 50 years of the intersection for the arts. One further element for the visual arts aspect, we were talking about visual arts, performing arts, and literary arts all being involved in this, is involves the archives of the.
Yeah, we have over 200 boxes of archives from the 50 years. And through Rick Prelinger and Megan Prelinger of the Prelinger Library, they introduced me to Lexa Walsh, this artist who considers herself a citizen archivist. And so she has gone through meticulously every one of those boxes, and she says she can get stuck for a week in one box with the details of things that are there, telling little things, you know, like a memo or, you know, phone messages written on the back of posters from the time and things like that. So it gives a fascinating and very layered portrait of intersection, not just the art that happened, but all the people who were working there over the years. And, you know, intersection went through, you know, at least five financial crisis over the years, and then, you know, moving from the North Beach to the Mission, and then Mission again, and then to SOMA. So all of the things that an organization goes through in its life cycle will be represented there, warts and all.
Wow, and it's such an amazing testament to being on your 50th year. That's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, you'll get a real sense of the layering of this organization.
So where are the selections from the archives going to be displayed?
It's going to be at Intersection at our home on 925 Mission Street. And they'll be displayed in the hallway entering the space and then throughout the space. And it's going to be a number of different ways to participate in it as well. We're also doing some interviews with pairs of people from the different decades through StoryCorps. You'll be able to come in and listen to some audio of different artists who've worked over the years. There's a recording of Guillermo Gomez Peña, a number of people that you'll be able to kind of plug in and play.
Let's move on to some of the performing arts aspects of the festival, this 50th year anniversary of Intersection for the Arts, and happened last Saturday, which is going to be happening at the Glide Memorial Church, I understand.
Yeah, it happened. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing, the roster of artists that gathered together to celebrate this. You know, from Bill Berkson, who was reading his poetry back at Intersection in the 70s, to new artists who are emerging. The musical lineup was incredible. Awesome Orchestra Collective, another one of our core members. So there was a 20-piece orchestra backing up singers like MacLeod and Diana Gameros. It was the perfect way to celebrate 50 years. Very moving.
And there's more coming up, though. Mugwumpin, who we will have on next week, will have Christopher White and Joe Estlack on for Mugwumpin Presents Blockbuster Season. Tell us about just a little tease of what they're going to be doing.
Well, they're looking at, you know, disasters and how the media shapes narratives around them. And, you know, whose narrative is it really? And so, you know, you get a very sort of biased viewpoint from the media standpoint sometimes about, you know, when something's happening that's, you know, seismic or, you know, a hurricane or something. So they're really taking that apart like they do in all their work and thoroughly examining it.
And the third element of this whole anniversary celebration gets into the literary arts. Or did we have anything else performing arts?
Well, we got Precarious Visions. One of the first coffee houses that they were working out of in the Tenderloin was called Precarious Visions, and I loved that. And I thought, well, what's a way to introduce new artists and everything? And so we're going to have a series of Monday nights starting November 28th for 8 Mondays where new artists are brought in and say, what are you thinking? What are you experiencing? Show us what you're doing so that we're opening the doors to Intersection to this next generation that's going to carry it forward. Mm-hmm. And then in addition, we're doing the 50-50 poetry nights. Intersection has a huge legacy of poets, poetry, and it was always on Tuesday nights. So we're doing them Tuesday nights in partnership with the new Tenderloin Museum. So it's going to be 50% legacy artists and 50% new poets that are coming up to the scene, and it's going to be a big mashup.
That's on October 16th and 13th, as well as November 10th and 17th at the Tenderloin Museum.
Yes, and most of these events are free. Blockbuster Season is a ticketed event, but the rest are absolutely free for the public. We hope you'll join us. Our website's www.theintersection.org.
Thank you so much, Randy Rollison, for sharing some of this incredible legacy of the Intersection for the Arts. And we'll have to have you on again.
Please, and support KALW.
We will take that cue perfectly. Here's Matt Martin to tell us more.
Thanks so much, David. And Randy, thank you so much for the kind words. You know, when I listen to Open Air every week, one of the things that I realize is how rare it is to have an institution where local arts organizations, a theater, music, dance, have a place where they can come and talk about their work, present them. And, you know, just know that there's a space, and that is what KALW, one of the roles that we play in the Open Air, the program that David and his producer, Neil Swinkles, bring to you every week. And I really want to reach out to people who care about the arts as something living and local and to encourage you to show your support right now at 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. This is what we're about, and we keep it alive together, one of us at a time, saying we support this, we want to see it we see it continue to thrive by making a call to 800-525-9917. This time next week, when David produces Open Air, you will not be hearing us ask for your support. It will be 8 months until we will be back here on Open Air saying, do you care about the local arts and do you want to have a place on the air for them? Your support right now shows that you care, shows that we continue it, and keeps it strong. The number to call, 800-525-9917, or you can do what a few great folks did just this hour. That is to go to KALW.org and give their support. I want to thank Rachel Holman in Oakland, Roma Gray in San Francisco, and Stephen Leader, also here in San Francisco, giving their support.
800-525-9917, or our website, KALW.org. As I mentioned earlier, during this hour of Open Air, especially if you're able to offer us a $200 gift, we'll give you a pair of vouchers for any event that's happening in the 2015-16 season of the San Francisco Playhouse. And that's available only by phone during this hour, a $200 gift, 800-525-9917. You know, Matt, I look back on just the number of amazing institutions that have passed through these doors in just this year. And we do this week after week. We support every organization from large and small, and would appreciate some of that love back. 800-525-9917 during this, our fall membership campaign.
This is really a creative community enterprise. It's a place where we think of KALW as part of the creative fabric of the Bay Area, a place not only where artists and musicians and dancers have a chance to talk about their work, but where creative work is done itself. We curate this. We bring forward their work, give them a platform. You keep it healthy when you make a call to 800-525-9917, or you can go to KALW.org if you have your mobile phone. Easy enough to click that donate button, look at the thank you gifts on offer there, and make your support. Today is the day to do it. We really need you to come through here on what we're trying to make our final day of our campaign. The number to call is 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
Give a shout-out to the arts during this arts-centered hour, 800-525-9917, or make your pledge online at KALW.org. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, David.
American Conservatory Theater kicks off their 2015-16 season with Stephen Adly Gyrgis's new dark comedy Between Riverside and Crazy through September 27th. Last season, San Francisco audiences witnessed his fast-paced writing with the San Francisco Playhouse production of The Mother Effer with the Hat, which we had guests on, which on Broadway starred Chris Rock and Bobby Cannavale and was nominated for a Tony. Between Riverside and Crazy won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for Drama for its playwright, and with its focus on a housing crisis, albeit in New York City, it's a timely work for San Francisco as well. Stephen Adly Gyrgis's plays have been produced both off and on Broadway, and as well as in the UK. He was raised on New York City's Upper West Side and as a member and former artistic director of the New York City's Labyrinth Theater Company. Still in New York, we reached him by phone to talk about his play. Stephen, welcome to Open Air.
Oh, thank you so much. Good afternoon.
Indeed. I'm also inviting our Open Air regular contributor, Peter Robinson, into the conversation. Peter reviews theater and events in the performing arts here in the Bay Area, and Peter caught the show the other day. So, Peter, we're going to welcome your comments as well.
Good. Good to speak to you, Stephen.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Peter.
Well, first of all, Stephen, congratulations on the Pulitzer Prize. That's kind of a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, it still feels kind of surreal, and I'm glad it happened, but I don't dwell on it too much, and you know I don't want to wear that mantle, but it's a wonderful thing and a deep honor, and you know I'm grateful.
Whenever you're feeling one of those artist's blues days, you just pull out the Pulitzer, I hope.
Yeah, you can also, you know what else gives you levity? You can look up the plays that won the Pulitzer, and not every play you might find is like, you know, you think is even that great. So like everything else, it has a, you know, Pulitzer has a very prestigious name, it's a very prestigious prize, but it's a prize awarded by human beings. So for all we know, there might be people who might think, oh, yeah, Stephen's play was really bad. It was one of those years. He got lucky. He got a Pulitzer.
Well, come on. Let's not sell yourself that short.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, yeah, it's great. It's great. It's a thing, and I was probably I should just own it. Yes, I got the Pulitzer, and it's great.
Does that put any kind of pressure on you, or does that change you as a writer? I imagine your email box is getting more full these days. Probably the phone's ringing a lot more often. Your regular mail's getting a lot in it as well.
I think, you know, I was reading an interview with Annie Baker, and she won the year before. And I think she said it best. She said the best thing about it is that I know that maybe, like, if I end up on Skid Row and just everything goes bad, that, like, some college might hire me to teach because I've won a Pulitzer. But to answer the question, really, I think, like, as soon as you start experiencing any success, even if that success is just going from a 25-seat theater to a 100-seat theater, immediately the pressure, you feel the pressure to repeat it, but you just have to let it go. Every time you write a play, it's a different journey, it's a different expression, and you just have to be willing to let the chips fall, you know, where they're going to fall.
Mm-hmm. It's also kind of a big deal to be the opener for the ACT season. Have you worked with Carrie Perloff before?
You know, I know her, and a few years ago I went and did a workshop for students out there, and they gave me tickets to see a play, and I was looking in the main stage. I was like, oh my God, I couldn't even imagine having a play done there, and now it's happening. So it's really exciting, and you know, the Bay Area has been very good to me in terms of producing my work, and it's, you know, I'm excited. I'm going to go out there probably next week and be able to spend a couple of days and see the play. So I'm just excited. And Carrie's like a great person, as I know her. I'm looking forward to spending more time with her, hopefully, when I'm out there.
Were you involved at all with this particular production, or are you just coming to see it?
Yeah, no, I wasn't involved at all. I think the director might have emailed me once or twice with a couple of questions, but no, but my understanding is that they have some Carl and a couple of people who have been experienced in doing, they've done my work before, which is kind of a cool thing, and so I'm psyched to come and see them, you know.
Yeah, Stephen, I just want to jump in. Peter Robinson, I went to the play, talking about success. The audience loved it, and I deliberately went on a matinee show. I avoided the press opening because I did want to see what an ACT audience would respond. And I've got to say, the enthusiasm from front to back of the auditorium was terrific. I think the actors caught the poetry of your words, and they certainly gave meaning to the expression. And I think my question, I identified at least 10 issues going on in this play, from rent control to policing to racism to religion to alcoholism to recovery to abortion to aging to sexuality and feminism, and finally to sort of local government and governmental systems. And I think to have brought all those in a two-hour period was just a great dramatic achievement. But my question is there another play about solutions or resolutions?
You know, I don't know. Hopefully the solutions will come in legislation, you know, and change, you know, internally. I think that a lot of times when we're, whether we're writing songs or plays, music, it's we're, if we're lucky, intuiting or reflecting the issues of the times. And most of the times, I think, like, I feel like we owe, as storytellers, we owe the audience a satisfying experience. But the genesis of the plays, at least for me, tends to be more in asking the questions than proposing or pretending to know an answer. I'm hoping to illuminate things in a certain way that make people more interested in finding a solution or finding an answer than they were when they walked in the theater.
I think one of the questions I really enjoyed, which comes from roughly the middle of the play, when one of the actors asks, you know, do we really know who we are? So this question of identity, and I think the characters did identify themselves through their speech and through their relationships, through the functions, and also through the dysfunctional aspect. But that question of identity, I think, has been particularly hot with playwrights, with authors, with poets, of the ambiguity, the moral ambiguity. The world is neither black nor white, but it's grey. And I think that's what I took primarily from this production. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, no, well, thank you. I think that's a good take. And I think it's, you know, what you're talking about is reflecting sort of a basic existential type question that we all ask. And I know something that I've thought when I look at how I was brought up, my mother and my father, it's made me ask certain questions. You know, when I'm good, am I good? My mother was a person that was considered to be really good. Everybody loved her. She was so good, good, good. She also had a crazy upbringing. So I was confronted, and I was always been told I was like my mother. So it was left with the question, like, is my mother good because she's good, or is she good because she was somehow raised to believe that she didn't have the option for making a decision based on her own needs, you know? So that therefore she's, you know, good by default. She's good by programming. And that maybe if she was more self-actualized, she'd be a nasty person, not a quote-unquote good person. And then I got, you know, I'm sort of like her, so I question it in myself all the time. But, you know, it sounds boring when I'm talking about it, but I try to do is what we're talking about now, to splash it with color and put it on the stage.
Well, I think you certainly pulled that off. I was smiling to myself because this is about private lives, and ironically, when you say private lives at ACT, you often end up talking about Noel Coward, but the language in this play, and this is why I went on a non-press evening, I wanted to see how the audience would respond to what I call street talk. I found it poetic, I found it worked, I found it authentic, and I was pleased to say that both the humour and the irony was responded to by this particular older audience. So I want to congratulate you on bringing what I call real live street talk into a theatre on a matinee show.
Let's back up for just a moment, guys, because Peter, you saw the show. Stephen, you wrote it. But for our audience members, we heard the issues that are being tackled here. But I'm wondering, Stephen, could you maybe give us a snapshot of the play?
Sure. It's sort of about, there's a father and son. The father is a retired police officer, retired African-American police officer, who was shot by another cop and has an outstanding lawsuit with the city, but it forced him to retire, and he's somewhat disabled. His wife dies. The son goes to move in to take care of the father. They're sort of natural antagonists, and the house is populated with this type of a sort of a surrogate family of, you know, I don't know, how would you call them, Peter? Like,
hangers-on, perhaps? Or
people are sort of living on the fringes of society, the fringes of the law. So it's a sort of a dysfunctional family, and people who haven't had strong things in family, but the retired cop, it becomes sort of like the de facto father figure. And then from there, there's a, you know, there's a plot strand that deals with an outstanding lawsuit because he was shot by a white cop, and that's where the issues of sort of race come in. But then there's also the issues of they're trying to evict him out of his apartment, it's rent control, and that's something that we're dealing with in New York. And what I understand is that also that's going on in San Francisco.
A very
right now,
big deal.
I think you know, I'm not an expert, but I feel like, you know, that the cities were not constructed to, you know, to just house millionaires, you know. And I know that New York, it was almost like a social contract. You come here, you bust your ass, and we subsidize things to help you sort of get started. That's why there was free public schools, free hospitals, free, you know, education, and rent control. And I imagine since San Francisco was a port city, there's probably a similar dynamic at one time, and now it's all haywire, normal people, you know.
And Riverside is going through a sense of gentrification, so you've got that changeover from the old neighborhood to something different. And I think Carl Lumbee, who plays Pops, and he is the main central character, in fact, he never leaves the stage, he does bring that role of a paterfamilias. He brings this strange motley crew all together, and even in his drinking moments, he's still the center force that allows the house dwellers to relate. I think that's probably at the essence of this story.
Yeah, and I think the other thing would be fair to say to potential audience members is that, you know, we're talking about a lot of heavy issues, but it's also very much, there's a lot of levity, there's a lot of comedy. In fact, I find that you can make characters more extreme and get away with it if they're funny, if they have a sense of humor, if there's an intelligence to them. And I think, I hope, that the characters here possess that. So who was it? Somebody, I think Herb Gardner says, like, you make them laugh, and then when their mouth is open, you can, like, you know, toss a little nugget in there.
Yeah, a joke is a very serious thing. And I think in terms of humor, I would call it New York humor. I mean, it transmits well here to the West Coast. But there was a lot of laughter in the theater on my particular visit. And then there was a sense of quietness afterwards, which means that the humor has transmitted, you're now going to have to think about it. And so the other side of comedy, of course, is tragedy. And I think it captures both those flavors in this very intense, it is an intense play. And I think that's a tribute both to the actors but also to the script.
Talking with Stephen Adley Gierges about his Pulitzer Prize-winning play Between Riverside and Crazy, opening the ACT season. Peter Robinson, our regular open-air contributor, also contributing to the conversation. I'm David LaTulippe. Newsday has called this deserving to be seen by anyone hungry for a smart, exuberantly funny urban dramedy. Congratulations on that combination of reviews there, Stephen.
Well, thank you.
Well, growing up, you mentioned your mom's influence. Now, growing up and living in New York, does a lot of this whole storyline come from personal experience then?
Yeah, I mean, usually play is going to be part imagination, part, you know, consternation, and mixed in with some, you know, autobiography. And my mom died in 2006, and I moved in with my dad the night that she died, and I took care of him in his old rent control apartment on Riverside Drive for, you know, until he died. He died in like 2010, so it was about 4 or 5 years, and it was a very deep, complicated, difficult time in our life. And when it first happened, I mean, I remember someone telling me right after my mother died, oh, well, you got to get your father a dog. He's got to have something to take care of, or, you know, they're old, they'll just drop dead. We never had a dog before, so I ended up getting a dog. There's a dog in the play, but he's an offstage. And then, again, what happened with me is that I started, we had an old rent control apartment, lots of rooms, so we just started having a lot of house guests. And they, you know, it tends to be people that need a place to stay or a little less stable. And so on the one hand, we had some sort of fringe characters living with us, but on the other hand, these were people who were so prime and ripe to have a relationship with an older man. So it kind of became a really beautiful thing, and I had, you know, friends living there, and they would, you know, constantly be talking with my dad, going to get him his lotto tickets, apple pie, this and that, and so it was lovely, and it was like a family. But also there was dysfunction, you know. And,
yeah, well, you've written candidly about your own experience on the fringe, and one of your fellow company members at Labyrinth was Philip Seymour Hoffman. Can you tell us about your relationship with him?
Yeah, you know, Phil was, you know, one of my closest friends, maybe my best friend, you know, and we met in 95. He directed five or six of my plays, he acted one of my plays, and, you know, he was a brother, and you know, the bottom line is that it's just, it's a shame that he's not here, and believe me, when he was around, he was really largely a person who had things together, mostly a guy that you would go to him for advice, you would go to him for help, in losing him the way we did, first of all, he would have never wanted to go out that way. Never. It would have been the last thing. He loved his kids, you know. But then also, it's just a testament to you know, there's a disease. It's a disease of addiction, you know. I mean, Phil sponsored. I had a friend who was, you know, in trouble, and I said to Phil, hey, can you sponsor this guy? Phil said, sure. He worked with him. And this friend of mine ended up dead, alone in his apartment with a needle in his arm. A couple years later, Phil helped out another friend of mine. This was an old girlfriend. She ended up dead, alone in her apartment with a needle in her arm. I never thought that would happen to him. It did. And, you know, I'll miss him for the rest of my life. There's certain things that I know will never be duplicated. But also, you know, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy for the kids, but at the end of the day, life is for the living, man, you know, and, you know, nothing, who knows what's going to happen when I hang up the phone, you know. Peter, I hope you have a long life, but you could leave that radio and get hit by a car and it's over. So we just, ultimately, you know,
carpe diem.
Death, even when it makes,
well, let's take it a day at a time before I go on the roads to San Francisco. But seriously,
yeah,
I think
it's a good point.
I think the transition that you made about people's expectations and wanting to live better lives, it constantly comes through. They all have wishes, and sometimes an expectation can lead to a downfall. And I think the way this play captures that does mirror something you were saying about Philip Seymour Hoffman, is that on the one hand we had the great acting, on the other hand we had the sadness and the depression and the tragedy. And I think this play brings those different elements together, whether it's living in a rent control and wondering how long do you stay there, whether it's recovering as an alcoholic, or whether it's facing the problem of aging in terms of Pops, how is he going to spend the rest of his life. And to me, this was the great achievement, that you could bring these different things together in a story for 2 hours and hold the audience in your hand. And I think that's what I really want to congratulate you for.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. I don't know what to say. You know, the characters are all different ages, but in a sense, life is one continuous. Sounds like a Hallmark card, but sort of one continuous coming of age story, and you know, it's either going to lead to a reckoning or, you know, an epiphany or something. But you know, we're never done wrestling, right? Until we're, you know.
And I think a sense of forgiveness, because we understand the people, we know their dilemma, and at the end, despite everything, we want to root for them. And I think that's the great art of putting something about life onto a stage and letting the audience enjoy it.
Stephen, your television writing credits include NYPD Blue and projects for CBS and NBC. Now, how has your writing dialogue for TV informed your playwriting, or is it vice versa?
Well, I mean, I much prefer to be in a theater, to be writing for the theater. But I've actually found every time I've worked in television or film, it's a really positive experience. And I mean, the one thing I would say about writing in television teaches you a lot about economy, you know, employing economy. It certainly teaches you the value and the preeminence of story.
Do you deal well with the editing process from...
Yeah. You know, it's like it really... You know, right now I'm working on this Netflix show that's going to debut next year with Baz Luhrmann, and it's called The Get Down, and it's about the birth of hip-hop in New York City in the 1970s. And you know, the thing you constantly wrestle with, it's such a big, wide canvas. It's like at the end of the day, we have how many minutes to tell the story? 53 minutes. You know, so that means, you know, every minute... Every beat, every scene has to be, you know, in service to the next one that's adding up to a whole, which is the story. Oh, there's Baz. Yeah. You want to say hello to San Francisco?
Hey, Baz Luhrmann, sure, say hello.
Hello, San Francisco.
Hey, Baz. Looking forward to your project on Netflix.
Oh, well, you know, look, it's quite like, I mean, nothing like else I've ever worked on, and the great thing is just how many extraordinary artists from the time and collaborators are involved with it. So, not the least of which is Mr. Stephen Gerger. So I'll give you back to him. It's nice to chat.
All right, Baz. We're looking forward.
It's Baz Luhrmann's birthday today, by the way.
Oh, my gosh. Happy birthday, Baz. Please convey that to him. Hey, Stephen, just one more thing. You're no stranger to the other side of the camera or audience, as well as you've got a half dozen or so films to your credit. Which side do you prefer?
Oh, I love acting. That's where I started, and that's what I kind of always wanted to do, and I never really studied writing, and so when I first started writing, I was writing from the perspective of what would I like to see on stage, what would I like to see enacted, or, like, you know, what would I like to live out, you know, through the writing experience that I wouldn't ever be able to act out. That's, to me, the biggest inspiration to me is actors on the stage. As the years have gone by, I've grown to be grateful, gain respect, and gain respect for writing process, and I've been hopefully continuing to learn along the way, but there's something about me I like the experience of going out on the stage and doing it, and you get that immediate gratification, it was good or it was bad, you know, and getting acting something you can do with other people. In fact, it requires other people. Writing comes with a lot of behaviors or methods that are very similar to the symptoms of depression. You know, I say it tends to be something you do alone when you're depressed. you're alone. I write at night when there's not people, less people around, you know, but when I'm depressed, I'm up all night. And so sometimes it's hard to tell, am I writing something or, you know, do I need to go see a psychiatrist? So that's sort of the trade-off, but...
Maybe today just talk things over with Boz. And I thank you.
He always has a rejuvenating effect, and I think you're really going to like the show. It's really his show.
Well, I thank you for taking the time today to talk about it, and I wish you a
pleasure.
Great run.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for all the kind words, and appreciate it so much.
Okay,
all
I enjoyed the play. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time, Stephen. Bye bye. So just a couple minutes, Peter, to talk about your other offerings in the theater world on the Marin side of things.
Yes, we've crossed the bridge. We're now at Marin Theater Company, and just opened is a play called The Oldest Boy. It's by Sarah Rule, and this, too, is a dramatic story. It opens in what is a Buddhist household with a mother hearing a knock on the door, and it is two monks arriving, and effectively what they want to do is to take her newborn baby off to India because he may be the next Lama. So this is a dramatic story. The mother's played by Christine Albright, the monk by Wayne Lee, and the father by Kurt Yui. It's an interesting story both about family, about the disruption of a family. It's also about life progressions, and you learn a lot about the way the Buddhist teachings can impact on, in this case, a part American family and part Buddhist family. It's a very moving play, and it's certainly, I think, if you want indirectly to see what is the problems that have existed in Tibet and why the Buddhists hold on to their faith so closely, this is a play that raises just those types of questions. Sarah Rule, you may recall, she had a previous play very differently, the Vibrator play. This time we're dealing with motherhood, but we're looking at it in a very different context. It's running at the Marin Theatre Company. It'll be running through the month of October. Well worth seeing, and the title of the play is The Oldest Boy. Highly recommended.
Thanks very much, Peter, and thanks for contributing to the conversation with not only Stephen Gierges, but with Boz Luhrmann, who joined the conversation at the last minute.
Well, it's just a big party going on back here. I've got to tell anybody who isn't listening and might be just the right time to hear what you can do if you want to contribute.
Well, you know what number to call, Peter. What is that number? Why don't you offer the number first?
Well, I can't say it as well as our official, but I will try my best. It's 800-525-9917. And join the party back here, because believe me, we're having fun.
Thanks, Peter. Back with Matt Martin as well to talk about this fascinating conversation we just had with Stephen Gierges in New York City. And then suddenly Boz Luhrmann comes in. He's working with on a Netflix project. And we had him on the air as well. Why not?
800-525-9917, your official number reader, Matt Martin, here with you, asking for your support. Conversation about the arts, about theater, about music and dance. It doesn't happen just anywhere on your radio dial. But if you value it, if on Thursday afternoons you say, I just want to listen to some people who are really into their work, hear about what they do, be taken inside of that work, and be told what is going on in the Bay Area that I can go and engage with. That's what we try to keep you informed about here at KALW. Open Air, one of the finest examples of that. David, I want to thank a couple of people who've gone online to KALW.org.
Please do.
Danny Murphy in San Francisco and also Edie Wade in Woodside both gave their contributions this hour. Thank you so much, Danny and Edie. We appreciate your support.
800-525-9917. And again, just this hour, if you're able to offer us a gift of $200, we'll give you a pair of vouchers to anything that the San Francisco Playhouse is offering during their 2015-16 season, including Dogfight with the actor I just talked with this hour, or anything else you're interested in. A $200 pledge when you call 800-525-9917. That gift is not available online, just by phone. 800-525-9917. Matt, just want to thank Neil Swinkles, my producer for Open Air, and to remind people that our shows are archived at KALW.org. And if you're involved with the performing arts organization here in the Bay Area and would like to perhaps hear a segment about them on Open Air, why not drop me an email, david@kalw.org.